The sadhana, I just want to talk a little bit about it, and then I'll lead you through it. It follows a very standard procedure for most sadhanas. It's a Sanskrit word. It refers to the practice of a particular form of a Buddha or a particular deity. And it's often, you know, it's written out as a text. So there's a certain kind of developmental stages that you often go through that you'll find, it might very much in common between, let's say, this practice, Tara, Chenrezig, and Manjushri, and so forth, although each practice will have its own, you know, different things that it does, as well as, you know, the common development. But we do these sadhanas in order to develop the Lam Rim realizations, but not only by working conceptually through the analytic meditation, but also by working symbolically, in terms of visualizing these Buddhas. Because when we visualize, here we're doing the medicine Buddha, we're not visualizing an external God. We're visualizing all the Lam Rim meditations appearing in the form of a Buddha. Okay? So it's kind of like, if you think of all the qualities and the realizations that you would get to by practicing the Lam Rim, the gradual path to enlightenment. Okay, so you think of the three principal aspects of the path, the determination to be free, bodhicitta, and correct view. You think of the six perfections. Okay, the six far-reaching attitudes, those of generosity, ethical discipline, patience, effort, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. Okay, so when you think of all these are like states of mind. We can't see them. We can't communicate with them directly. But when we, so they appear in the form of a Buddha. Okay, and that symbolizes all these states of minds and realizations. So we do the sadhana to, you know, get in touch with these states of mind in a different way than we do when we're doing the analytic meditation on the Lam Rim. So when we're doing the analytic meditation, for those of you, for example, who have the Lam Rim CDs, there we're thinking about the various teachings in terms of our own life. So it's very helpful to have both approaches. Okay, the checking or analytical meditation of the Lam Rim plus this symbolic representation that you get here in Tantra. But they're not separate. Okay, and it's not sufficient just to do one of them. Okay, some people really like doing the sadhana, so you visualize, you chant mantra, you feel so blissful afterwards, but they don't like sitting down and doing the analytic meditations because you have to think and you have to look at your life, and, you know, and it's actually the analytic, the checking meditations that make a lot of transformation in our mind and that help us learn to evaluate our own thoughts and emotions and to actually change them. Okay? Because we could intellectually say, oh, anger causes many problems. It's not such a good thing. But when anger comes in our own mind, we don't think that, do we? We think anger is good. And anyway, I'm not angry. I'm right. And there's a difference between being angry and right. And I'm right. You know, and if I'm angry, I have a right to be angry because I'm right. Okay? So we know a lot of stuff up here, but when things come up in our life, they're gone. We don't have it in here. So these analytic meditations, I think, are very effective from bringing the understanding here into here, because we're really looking at our life very specifically and applying the teachings and thinking about them. Okay? So we need to do that. On the other hand, it's very nice doing this, the symbolic representations, because that gets us into a different level of practice where we're working with symbology. And we human beings are very symbolic, aren't we? I mean, language is nothing more than symbols. And art is symbols, and music is symbols. And we have icons on the computer, they're symbols. So we're always dealing in symbols. So it's a similar thing when we're doing these sadhanas. Okay, so the two practices go very much together. And I think that's quite important to understand, because sometimes you find people who, you talk about Buddhism in the West, and they talk about Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, and the Tibetans practice Vajrayana, as if that's all the Tibetans practice, or that's all the Vajrayana is, like it's a separate branch. It's not. The Vajrayana is, and Vajrayana includes these kinds of sadhanas and visualization meditations. That is a branch of Mahayana. It's not separate from Mahayana Buddhism. And you practice Mahayana based on the Theravada teachings. Okay. So if you're practicing Vajrayana, you have to know Theravada, you have to know Mahayana. So for somebody to say, oh, I'm a Vajrayana practitioner, I don't want to learn the Theravada teachings, or I don't respect those scriptures, or they're not necessary, that's a complete misconception, you know, or to say that similarly about the general Mahayana teachings. Okay? So it's important to learn all of it. And you can't just go to Vajrayana as if it's a separate thing and leave out the Theravada and Mahayana. It just doesn't, you know, you can't get anywhere in your practice if you do that. Okay? I'm saying this because sometimes I look in Buddhist magazines in America, and sometimes they have interesting ideas. Okay, from people who maybe haven't studied or who don't understand. Okay, so when we start out a sadhana, we usually visualize the objects of refuge, you know, and this is done in different ways. Sometimes it's Shakyamuni. In this case, we're visualizing the medicine Buddha. In some sadhanas, when you visualize, you know, it's out in front. In this case, we're visualizing on our head. It doesn't really matter, okay? When you're visualizing, you're not trying to see the deity with your eyes. Okay, so don't roll your eyeballs up like, where's Medicine Buddha? Come on, I'm not seeing you. but you're just imagining. Okay, and we actually have very good powers of imagination. Many people think they can't visualize, but if I say, chocolate cake. Do you have a visualization? Okay. If I say chocolate chip cookies, do you have a visualization? Okay. Yeah, even your eyes are open. You have very clear visualization of what chocolate chip cookies look like. If I say apple, okay, you have a visualization of an apple in your mind, an image? That's all visualizing the Buddha is there's an image in our mind. Okay? It's actually much better for our mind to visualize the Buddha than it is to visualize chocolate cake. You know, because usually when we visualize chocolate cake, what is our emotional response? Attachment. Greed. Okay? When we visualize the Buddha, then we respond differently with, you know, emotionally. There's a sense of respect, a sense of aspiration to develop the same qualities as a Buddha. Okay? Somebody remarked at dinner last night that they find it very easy to substitute the Buddha for God. Okay, and it is easy when we do these sadhana practices, if we don't understand properly, to just think, okay, God's no longer this white, you know, this white male on the top of the Sistine Chapel with a beard, you know, our usual image of God, you know, as he's reaching out his hand to Adam or whatever he's doing. All of a sudden, God no longer looks like that. All of a sudden, he's blue, you know, and he has an alms bowl and an aurora plant. You know, but we just take the same qualities that we attribute to God and project them on the Buddha. Okay. We have to be very careful because most of us grew up in a Judaic Christian culture where we have these kinds of ideas. So it's, you know, we need to be careful and not just change God's colors, okay? But still think of it as God. So let's do a little comparison here between God and Buddha. Okay. As the way, and here I'm talking about the way, the common general way that in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition people think about God. I'm not saying that everybody in those traditions thinks about God this way, because they don't. People have very different understandings of God within the traditions, especially when you get to the meditators and the really contemplatives. They see God in a different way. But I'm just talking about the general Sunday school version of God that most of us grew up with, okay? And also I'm making vast generalizations because, you know, Judeo-Christian Islamic is, you know, there's a lot of different traditions in there. And even within Buddhism, there's a lot of different traditions. So I'm just working on a very general thing. And as these, beings are described, okay? Well, one quality of God, yeah, is a creator of the universe. Yeah. In Buddhism, Buddha did not create the universe. Okay. Our karma created the universe. Our mind created the universe. Okay. So there's not this idea of a creator being who began the whole thing in Buddhism. Okay. Similarly, God is seen as kind of a manager of the universe. God can make things happen. God has a will and a plan, and he manages things, and he, you know, you somehow have to figure out what God's will is and what God's plan is and, you know, do your part in it. In a Buddhist sense, there's no such thing as Buddha's will or Buddha's plan, and Buddha doesn't manage the universe. Okay? In other words, things happen in the universe, again, because of our mind, because of our karma. Okay? Karma means the actions that we create. Yeah. So there's no supreme being who has a will or a plan or who's trying to teach us lessons or anything like that. You know, the universe simply works by cause and effect. Causes produce effects. While the effects are happening, we do more things and we react to them. We create more causes and they produce more effects. Okay? Both God and Buddha are seen as, you know, more spiritually advanced than we are. Okay, that's in common. You know, in other words, in Buddhism, we're not alone in this cold universe. There are beings who are more advanced, who can lead us and guide us, who, you know, can influence what we experience, but not because, we've pleased them and gotten them on our side. Okay. In other words, in a theistic religion, you usually have to please God so that God will want to help you. In Buddhism, when we pray, it may sound like, you know, we're trying to please Buddha, or we're asking Buddha for realizations, or asking Buddha for things. But that's not actually what's happening in these prayers. What we're doing is we are making our own mind more receptive to the enlightening influence of the Buddhas. Okay, so it's not like we're asking the Buddha, please help me, because otherwise if we didn't ask, the Buddha wouldn't help. And it's not like we have to make offerings to the Buddha so that the Buddha's pleased with us and thinks that we're nice, you know, because the Buddha's already developed full, you know, supreme compassion. Yeah, but when we're doing all of this, what we're trying to do is open our own mind and heart and be more receptive to the energy of the enlightened beings. And the analogy that's usually given here is, you know, the sun. The sun is like the Buddha and the Buddha's enlightening influence. The sun shines everywhere indiscriminately. And you don't have to ask the sun to shine. And you don't have to say, you know, please, please, here's some flowers and some, you know, what did you guys give the Buddha today? Some Trader Joe's. Dolce de leche. Maybe the Buddha's gonna really like that. I don't know, but you know, we're not doing it to convince the Buddha that we're good or to, you know, get the Buddha on our side. But the sun, you know, like the sun, the Buddha's compassion just goes everywhere. Yeah. Now, if a bowl is right side up, that sunlight's gonna go in it. Right. If the bowl's upside down, the sun can be really bright, but no sunlight's going to go on the bowl. Okay. That's not a problem of the sunlight. It's a problem of the bowl. Okay. So it's similar with our mind. The Buddha's enlightening influence, you know, the Buddha's ability to teach us or ripen our mind or influence us in a positive way, it's always there like the sunlight, because the Buddha has the compassion that extends everywhere. But, you know, when our mind is really fogged over with, you know, distraction or greed or arrogance or jealousy or desire or whatever, then our mind is like the upside down bowl and no light can go in it. You know? The reason that we do all these different prayers to purify our mind and to accumulate merit or positive potential is to try and make our mind like a right side up bowl. Okay? So it's, you know, not Buddha, I offer you the universe, the mandala, so, you know, please think I'm good and, you know, do something for me. It's, you know, my mind is totally fogged over by my own greed. Yeah, my own attachment to stuff. So in order to free my mind from that and open my heart and focus on what's important instead of my own wants and needs, I imagine giving everything in the universe to the Buddha, because then I'm not attached to it. It doesn't belong to me. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? Okay. So there's a difference also in how we, you know, what the meaning of prayers or requests are when between doing that with God and doing that with Buddha. Okay? Coming back again a little bit to this comparison, the God is seen as omnipotent. Okay? God can do anything. He's all powerful. The Buddha is not omnipotent. Okay? Because if a Buddha were all powerful, because a Buddha has more compassion for us than we have for ourselves, if a Buddha had the power from their own side, independent of us, to alleviate all of our suffering and bring us all happiness, a Buddha would not hesitate for a moment to do that, because they have so much compassion. Yeah. Whereas a Buddha, you know, is not said to be omnipotent in that way, because, as I was just explaining, the Buddha's ability to influence us depends on our receptivity. Okay? So a Buddha cannot act independent of our mental states and our karma. Yeah. So that's why a Buddha is not considered omnipotent. Yeah. And whereas God is said to be omnipotent. The thing about positing an omnipotent deity is, you know, it brings up some kind of doubt that if this deity were all powerful, why don't they make that? So Buddhism doesn't run into that difficulty because, you know, there's no assertion that a Buddha is all powerful and can act independently of us.